On this episode of Death Row Stories, a millionaire is accused of brutal murders in a downtown Miami hotel.
The crime scene was a bloody, bloody mess.
But after a death sentence, one man fights to save his life.
You go into federal court and say, my guy's innocent. They say, well, too bad, mate. That's got nothing to do with it.
And what he discovers will turn the case upside down.
Anybody in the world would say, what? That's not allowed.
There were a series of questions that should have been asked.
This case is more evidence that was covered up than any other case I've ever seen in decades.
There's a body in the water.
He was butchered and murdered.
Many people proclaim their innocence.
In this case, there are a number of things that stink.
This man is remorseless.
He needs to pay for it with his life.
The electric chair flashed in front of my eyes.
Get a conviction at all costs. Let the truth fall where it may.
This was a very sensational crime. How many times do you have a double homicide in a downtown Miami hotel?
The crime scene was a bloody, bloody mess.
The father was shot six times. He was crawling, trying to escape. The son was shot, quote, execution style. So this was a pretty shocking case.
The dead men were Derek Mu Young, a father of four, and his youngest son, Dwayne, who had just been accepted to law school. A few hours after the shootings, a journalist named Neville Butler contacted police saying he'd seen his boss, 47-year-old Chris Maharaj, pull the trigger.
Our big break was when we received a telephone call that there was an individual by the name of Neville Butler that wanted to speak to us.
Butler described the crimes in painstaking detail to Burmaster.
Chris opened the door and came out with a gun in hand, with a glove on. And that's when I almost passed out. When I asked Chris, what on earth is this? He says, keep out of this. That's when he fired the first shot at his leg. Mu Young dashed at him. And that's when Chris must have let go about four or five bullets.
The television that was there, the lamp and everything had all been shot up. The screen of the television had been destroyed from a bullet.
He turned his attention now to the son. He said, come with me. And he took him up the stairs and told him, kneel down, face the wall. And then the next thing I heard was, boom, he shot the boy in the back of his head.
Chris Maharaj was a wealthy importer from England who'd started a newspaper business in Miami. He was quickly charged with two counts of first-degree murder. The maximum sentence, the death penalty.
But it didn't look too good for Chris. The lead detective, John Burmaster, said that he had denied ever being in room 1215, while his fingerprints were all over the place, so that was a lie. Chris denied ever having a gun. He clearly did have a 9mm pistol. The ballistics expert came in and said that's the type of gun that was used for this murder. He had invested in property, and Derek Mu Young was supervising that property. According to Chris, Derek had stolen $441,000, had just embezzled it. So Chris had a motive. He clearly hated the Mu Youngs. And finally, the icing on the cake was their star witness, Neville Butler.
Chris's case went to trial. In court, the defense presented no alibi witnesses, and Chris never took the stand. Ron Petrillo was the defense investigator on the case.
I knew when I heard all of this going on coming out of the jury room what the final outcome was going to be.
The jury returned guilty verdicts in less than 4 hours.
And then when it went to the penalty phase, the judge gave him the death sentence.
During his ruling, the judge declared that the coldness and calculated manner in which the defendant executed his heinous plan cannot be overstated. Chris would officially begin his time on death row.
Once they gave me the death sentence, I said, God knows I am innocent. They will not kill me. They cannot.
Chris was from England, a country that had abolished the death penalty for murder in 1965. With one of their citizens on death row, the British government asked Clive Stafford Smith to investigate Chris's case. Clive was a young, idealistic lawyer who'd made a name for himself fighting death penalty cases on a pro bono basis.
By the time I got there in 94, he'd been sentenced to death. He'd gone up to the Florida Supreme Court on appeal, to the US Supreme Court, had come back down. And so my first thought was, oh my goodness, how did I let myself in for this?
Despite his reluctance, Clive agreed to meet with the man he presumed was guilty.
I never talk to people when I first meet them about, did you do it? They don't know you, they don't trust you. But Chris was one of those quite rare people who insisted on giving me an A to Z lecture about the fact that he didn't do it. And, you know, I found that quite convincing, although I will say the evidence against him was pretty strong at the time.
As a former cop, Ron Petrillo also had doubts about Chris's innocence when he joined the case.
Initially, I thought Chris just killed these guys. But I'm looking to see where the evidence takes me, and it didn't add up. The deeper I got into the investigation, it began to dawn on me that Chris was innocent.
Ron was very, very loyal to Chris, and he carried on after the case was over, even though he wasn't being paid or anything.
Ron and Clive noticed discrepancies in the prosecution's story of the murders and set out to look for answers.
I've demanded to see the files of the prosecutor and of the police. I start going through it, and I'm sitting there with some extraordinarily bad coffee in the police headquarters. Going through this very carefully tabbed file, I discover that Neville Butler, the star witness, failed his polygraph test. I discover notes that show that the police knew that Chris had lost his gun before the murders ever took place. This case, there's more evidence that was covered up than any other case I've ever seen in decades.
Before Chris Maharaj was put on death row for the murders of Derek and Dwayne Moo Young in Florida, he'd been living a life of luxury in England.
Chris had come to England when he was quite young, worked incredibly hard, and become a millionaire.
In England, Chris married and had four kids while working his way up from a truck driver to a business magnate.
I was in business importing all sorts of foodstuffs. I started small and I then became the largest importer.
He was a very flamboyant millionaire here in London. He'd got his Rolls Royce, and then he began to get into horse racing.
I was able to purchase 100 horses. I had 12 trainers.
Chris amassed the second biggest stable of racehorses in England. Only the Queen owned more. Having emigrated from Trinidad, Chris also mingled with members of Parliament, gaining entrance into an upper-crust, lily-white society rarely available to immigrants of color.
When I got arrested for these murders, Honorable Peter Bottomley, the Member of Parliament, said, we know Maharaj, something is wrong, he's been framed.
Chris first met the men he'd been accused of killing when he began importing their fruit from Jamaica. After years of doing business together, Derek Moo Young asked Chris to invest in houses he was building in Florida.
My plan was when I reached 65 in England, I was going to spend the summer months in England and the winter months here in Port Lauderdale, and I invested the money with him.
But according to Chris, the Moo Youngs took his money and embezzled it. They also incorporated as KDM Distributors, a name eerily similar to Chris's company, and allegedly started drawing money from Chris's accounts.
According to Chris, Derek had stolen property worth $441,000. So you could see why Chris would be very angry. He wanted to put an end to this.
Chris was used to settling disputes with words, not weapons. He sued the Mu Youngs and told Clive he expected to win.
There was no question of me killing him for the money. As a matter of fact, killing him would have made him lose the money, obviously.
But if Chris then had little reason to walk into the DuPont Hotel with a loaded weapon, why was there so much evidence pointing to him as a suspect? According to Chris, he went to the DuPont at 9:30 a.m. on the morning of the murders to meet a potential business partner for the newspaper he'd started in Miami. Neville Butler, the man who would claim to see Chris commit the murders, set up the meeting.
Neville Butler took me up to the apartment, opened the apartment.
But the man Chris was supposed to meet was not there.
Neville Butler said perhaps he went out.
The two men waited for nearly an hour.
He insisted that I wait. I said, no, I'm going. I am never late for an appointment. I'm always on time. And I left.
At 10:30, Chris drove 25 miles to Fort Lauderdale and attended meetings during the hours when the murders took place. And he could prove it. Chris had alibi witnesses, including an employee at his newspaper named Tino Geddes.
Tino Geddes swore to me that he had been with Chris, gone to lunch, stayed by Chris.
The manager at a restaurant Chris frequented also clearly remembered seeing Chris at lunch.
I know I saw Chris the day of the murders because there was a person who was sick and I needed to come in and fill in for that person. It doesn't seem like there's any way possible that he could have killed people at 12 o'clock and then been in for lunch sometime between 12 and 2.
Five other witnesses would come forward, placing Chris with them on the day of the murders.
I haven't any doubt at all that I saw him that day. So that was 12:30 within that time.
Yet Neville Butler told Miami PD homicide detective John Burmaster a convincing account of seeing Maharaj commit the murders in cold blood. Someone had to be lying. Butler was a home run for police. Not only could he identify Maharaj, he would go on to lead Detective Burmaster to where he and Chris planned to meet for dinner.
I was at Denny's having dinner, and I saw Neville Butler walk in with a man. He pulled out a card and showed me, "I'm Detective Burmaster. You've been arrested for murder." I said, "So what are you talking about?"
Chris would be taken for interrogation, and stark differences would emerge about what was said during that conversation.
John Burmaster said that Chris denied ever being in room 1215 while his fingerprints were all over the place.
Chris's fingerprints would only be significant if he denied being in the room to police.
I told him that I went to the hotel. I was in room 1215 for about an hour.
Burmaster also said that Chris denied ever having a gun. He clearly did have a 9mm pistol.
That is another manufactured answer by Mr. Burmaster. I told him, yes, I owned a gun. I owned one when I was living in Trinidad. In England, I owned a gun.
But if Burmaster thought Chris was trying to hide something, he never took a sworn statement during the interrogation to document that fact. And a lie detector test Chris took later that evening would support Chris's version of events.
They had one of the top polygraph examiners in Florida do these tests. Chris passed. That was plain and simple.
Despite passing the lie detector and having numerous alibi witnesses, Chris was booked and held without bail. It would be a year before he'd get his day in court.
Put it this way, I went from living like a prince to existing like an animal.
On the eve of trial, Chris and his investigator, Ron Petrillo, felt good about their chances.
Chris had 7 or 8 alibis. I had located people and gotten sworn statements that put him squarely in Broward County, some 25 miles away, during the time that these murders occurred.
But with his trial approaching, Chris got word that one of his key alibis, Tino Geddes, was about to change his story.
Everything that Tino had said, that he was with Chris, that Chris was in Broward County when the murders took place, it was all a lie, according to Tino.
Geddes was now going to testify for the prosecution, and no one, including Chris, was prepared for the accusations Geddes was about to make. Chris Maharaj was facing the death penalty for the murders of Derek and Dwayne Mu Young when shortly before trial, Tino Geddes, one of Chris's key alibi witnesses, had a dramatic change of heart.
Tino Geddes worked for Chris at a newspaper that Chris owned. From day one, he swore to me that he had been with Chris. Now Tino's changed the story. On the day that the murders were committed, he wasn't with Chris. Chris wanted the Mu Youngs dead.
Tino was now claiming Chris's actions in the murders had been premeditated. John Castronakis was a prosecutor on Chris's case.
Mr. Geddes told us that he, in fact, had been with Krishna Maharaj on several other occasions when he had tried to kill the victims and members of their family. And that, in fact, that Krishna Maharaj's sole motive in life at that point in time was the death of Derek Mu Young.
Tino said that Chris had done a dry run at the DuPont Plaza Hotel with him where he had prepared to murder the Mu Youngs. And Chris was going to burst through from room 404 to room 406 to do it. I went to the DuPont Plaza Hotel. There's no door between 404 and 406. There are all sorts of reasons why Tino was lying. The question was why.
Why do you think Geddes changed his story?
Tino Geddes had a DUI trial coming up, and he was also being charged for smuggling guns and ammunition.
He was smuggling a whole bunch of guns into Jamaica at a time when there were very, very harsh sentencing. My experience is the vast majority of people, when they face life in prison, are willing to say what the prosecution wants them to say about pretty much anything, and probably about their grandmother.
In Tino Geddes' misfortune, the prosecution sensed an opportunity and flew to Jamaica to help their new witness.
Paul Ridge and John Castronakis went to testify in his behalf and got him off with, I think, just a fine instead of doing jail time. And I thought, well, okay, they're doing their job. Till I found out that they and Tino went to a strip club. A lot of people would say, well, what they do in their own time is their own business, but they're there on my dime as a taxpayer testifying on behalf of this man, and they go to a strip club with him? Yeah, I'd say that they got a little too close.
Chris's trial began on October 5th, 1987, almost exactly 1 year after the murders occurred. It was presided over by Judge Howard Gross, known to friends as Mousy because of his small frame and large ears. Chris's attorney was Eric Hendon, who helped other accused killers avoid the death penalty. During opening arguments, the prosecution contended that the Mu Youngs were innocent businessmen gunned down by Chris, cold-blooded killer. Eric Hendon told the jury they would hear fictional stories from the prosecution worthy of a Hollywood drama. But on the third day of trial, the proceedings came to a sudden halt.
What happened on day three of the trial, if you can believe it, is that Howie the Mouse doesn't show up because he's been arrested taking kickbacks in another case, and he'd been caught by law enforcement agents posing as drug dealers, of all people.
Mousy's removal was a golden opportunity for Chris's lawyer, Eric Hendon, to call for a mistrial. With a new trial, Hendon would know the prosecution's arguments ahead of time. Without a new trial, the judge replacing Mousy could face deciding a death sentence without hearing all the evidence.
I wanted a mistrial, and Hendon told me, my advice to you is not to ask for a mistrial.
Hendon, he said that they would just go on with the trial because he felt he had made some headway and they had a good jury.
Why would he do this?
Probably the main motivation was that he was on a set fee, and you're going to have to start over, and that cuts into your fee.
Hendon would maintain he'd worked hard on behalf of his client, but letting the trial continue seemed like an unusual choice, and the jury would go on to hear 6 days of testimony, all directed against Chris. Neville Butler testified about the graphic details of the murders he said he'd watched Chris commit. Tino Geddes told prosecutors Chris had asked him to fabricate an alibi. And Detective John Burmaster said Chris had tried to cover up the crime during his interrogation. When the case was finally turned over to the defense, Hendon's judgment would again come into question.
Eric said to me that if he didn't call any witnesses, he would have two shots at the jury in closing argument. I said to him, but you're not going to do that. I've got all these witnesses. You're not going to do that. He didn't answer me.
Eric Hendon's defense case for Chris would consist of only 9 words.
Eric stood up and said, Your Honor, the defense rests. Eric didn't call a single witness. Nothing. I thought Chris was going to rip the skin off my forearm.
I just couldn't believe my head. I was shocked.
That's not often in a capital case you get 6 alibi witnesses putting your client somewhere else. Why on earth would the lawyer not put those on?
I have never wanted to hit another human being. Physically attack another human being like I did that day with Eric Hendon.
The jury responded to Hendon's strategy by returning guilty verdicts for 2 first-degree murders. They would also vote whether to recommend the death penalty, and with Florida being the only remaining state where a simple majority is needed in sentencing, the vote in favor of death passed by a count of 7-5. The judge who'd replaced Mousy agreed. Chris would be sentenced to die in the electric chair.
Chris fainted. Chris hit the floor. Passed out completely.
When the verdict took place and I found guilty, I thought, this can't be real. It is unreal. I couldn't believe in America you could get found guilty for something you didn't do.
When Clive finally got the chance to appeal Chris's case in 1995, he immediately set out to present all the alibi witnesses who were never called at trial.
I talked to the alibi witnesses. They were very convincing. And they said it's true. Chris was not at the DuPont Plaza Hotel at 12 noon that day because he was with us up in Fort Lauderdale.
But Chris's alibis fell on deaf ears, as the courts would only consider whether Chris had received a fair trial in 1987.
It's actually very hard to win a case on just saying the facts are wrong. Mostly it's all about what people disparagingly call legal technicalities.
But Clive did have an opening. If he could show Chris's attorney, Eric Hendon, had been ineffective in representing Chris, he would open the door to a new trial and new witnesses. Ben Cuney also worked on Chris's appeals and would cross-examine Hendon.
Eric Hendon was over his head at that time. He needed help in a case of this magnitude, and Chris has suffered the consequences as a result of his lawyer's errors.
But Hendon needed to admit, under oath, that he'd made mistakes. And when Ben asked him why he didn't present Chris's alibis, Hendon told the court, It appeared to me as if these were alibi witnesses who had been sought out. It seemed all too convenient. In other words, Hendon didn't believe any of Chris's alibis.
How is one lawyer going to be the judge of the credibility of a witness who could be the key to a not guilty verdict? That's not a decision for a lawyer to make, not with the stakes this high.
Hendon, he said he had a strategic reason for not putting on the alibi. He thought the alibi was too good. Now, once a lawyer says that, then it takes it out of the realm of the lawyer's ineptitude and then becomes a strategic decision by the lawyer that the courts won't second guess.
Ultimately, the court disagreed with Clive and Ben, refusing to find that Eric Hendon had been ineffective. Clive was still convinced Chris was innocent, and while preparing further appeals, he came across the prosecution's files and discovered evidence he felt police and prosecutors apparently did not want Chris to have.
I start going through it, and I discover that the police knew that Chris had lost his gun before the murders ever took place. I discover that Chris had actually told them from the very beginning he'd been in room 1215, so all those fingerprints, there was a perfectly innocent explanation.
Clive had also seen photographs from the crime scene of a briefcase belonging to the Mu Youngs. The contents were something Ron Petrillo had requested to see before Chris's trial.
I went into the detective bureau. Burmaster was too busy to see me, and he sent a young girl out, and I opened the briefcase, and it's empty. And I said to her, where are the contents? And she said that Detective Burmaster told her to tell me that he didn't find anything of any evidentiary value and returned the contents to the family.
Burmaster had said that they'd got rid of the Mu Youngs' briefcase. That wasn't true. Here in the file were hundreds of pages of notes of the Mu Youngs. There's all sorts of intriguing stuff. It was like Christmas, really. Far from being the sort of innocent people making $24,000 a year that they were portrayed at trial, the Mu Youngs, they were offering loans around the Caribbean to the tune of first $100 million, then $250 million. It's just extraordinary stuff.
They didn't have a pot to piss in or a window to throw it out. Where were they coming up with $100 million?
Shortly before their deaths, Derek and Dwayne Mu Young also took out over $1 million worth of life insurance. The company that issued those policies found the timing suspicious and hired an attorney to investigate.
Theoretically, the Mu Youngs were engaged in an import-export business, but the Mu Youngs' headquarters, which consisted of a garage at the family home, only had left an old telex machine and no documents whatsoever. The more we learned about it, it seemed that they were either selling fictitious goods entirely or they were laundering the money.
But if the Mu Youngs were involved in money laundering, whose money were they laundering?
Those kinds of dollars and narcotics often go hand in hand in Miami, particularly in the 1980s. I think that's fair to say.
This was Miami in the 80s.
Do you know, I didn't really get that. I didn't really understand Miami in the 80s.
Say hello to my little friend!
Federal agents have seized 25,000 pounds of cocaine.
In the early 1980s, the Mu Youngs were operating in a city where drug smuggling was bringing in an estimated $7 to $12 billion a year.
The banks in Miami had more money than all the other banks in the country put together. People were walking in and buying Mercedes and Porsches for cash.
Miami could be described as the overseas corporate headquarters for money laundering for the Colombians.
With so much drug money at stake, cartel violence ballooned into what would become known as the Cocaine Wars, and law enforcement was quickly overwhelmed.
We have bank robberies, kidnapping, extortion. One of the guys shot me through the fingers in the back of the arm. He's standing between my legs. I went to kick him, and he shot me in the groin. I figure he's going to kill me.
These drug dealers were the most violent, desperate criminals that we ever had in South Florida. They'd see a pretty girl in a car, and they'd rape and kill the girl and keep the car.
In 1980, Miami's homicide rate doubled, turning the city of Sun and Beaches into the murder capital of the nation.
There have been so many murders throughout Greater Miami lately that a special refrigerated truck is now being used to store all the bodies.
It turned out that it was a refrigerated truck that they had rented from Burger King to hold the overflow of bodies.
Clive was beginning to see the frame around the picture of the murders, and he now wondered whether the Mu Youngs had found themselves caught in the crosshairs of Miami's cartel violence. Clive felt the roadmap to Miami in the 80s could be found in the Mu Youngs' briefcase.
We figured out that the Mu Youngs were laundering money for the cartels. They got greedy, and they come up with this great plan that they're going to skim 1% off the money. So if you're ripping off the Colombian drug cartels, that's a slightly stronger motive for you getting killed than what was going on with Chris. It totally reframed the case. Now we have a huge alternative suspect.
a suspect that happened to be staying in the room directly across the hall from the murders. Clive Stafford Smith had uncovered evidence suggesting that before the Muyungs were murdered, they may have been stealing money from a Colombian drug cartel. And a photo Ron Petrillo had seen from the crime scene would buttress Clive's theory.
When you look at the crime scene photos, there are blood drops in the hall, and there is blood smear on the door frame of 1214. It begs the question, who is in 1214?
Did you ultimately find out who was in
1214? Oh, yeah, I wound up bribing an employee and found out it was a guy named Mejia.
Jaime Vallejo Mejia told police he was an importer-exporter from Colombia. But the truth was, Mejia would soon be busted by the Drug Enforcement Administration for money laundering.
Detective Burmaster said, I chatted with him for a few minutes, standing in the hallway, and he didn't seem to know anything.
This is the only other guy who's there, the only other room occupied on the 12th floor. We discover that Mejia was wanted at the time of Chris's trial for a conspiracy to take $40 million in cash in a suitcase to Switzerland.
Former DEA agent Dave Lorino had his own opinion about Mejia.
Jaime Mejia was involved in the money laundering business. Not only was he working for Escobar at the time, but there was some money being done for the Ochoa organization as well. Jaime told the police that he ran an import-export company and worked for U.S. insurance companies. That doesn't make any sense. People who sell insurance don't run an import-export business. And why is there blood on his door if everything that happened across the hall? It doesn't add up. There were a series of questions that should have been asked of him that weren't asked.
Officers took a brief statement from Jaime Mejia and let him go. Would the jury at Chris's trial have found an alternate explanation for the murders if they had seen evidence about the Muyungs and Jaime Mejia? While preparing Chris's appeals, Clive pieced together his own theory of the scheme that played out that day.
But what happened was this, in my mind. The Muyungs were laundering money for the cartels. They started skimming money off the top. They then got in trouble. And it was set up so that they would meet in the DuPont Plaza Hotel, and Chris was meant to be there too. All three of them were meant to die. It was then going to be left as a murder-suicide, where you've got the two guys you dislike killed, and you've got someone else fingered for it. Clearly, Neville Butler was there. Somehow, Jaime Vallejo Mejia must have been supervising it.
But the courts weren't the least bit interested in Clive's theoretical suspects or the evidence he'd uncovered. Innocence wasn't the issue.
One of the bizarre things that I think most Americans have no idea about is that whether you're innocent or not is not a legal issue. You go into a federal court on a habeas petition and say, my guy's innocent, and they say, well, too bad, mate, that's got nothing to do with it. And the judge actually said that in Chris's case.
But Clive did manage to introduce a document into the proceedings that the courts could not ignore. A document showing Chris's death sentence had been written by someone other than Chris's judge.
I'd seen a certain amount of judicial corruption. I find in the prosecution file orders sentencing Chris to death that were dated 13 days before the sentencing hearing. They were written by the prosecutor because it said JSK, and that's obviously John Castronakis.
In allowing prosecutor John Castronakis to write Chris's death sentence, the judge who replaced Mousy had apparently decided to impose the death penalty before hearing Chris's character witnesses at the sentencing phase of trial.
The judge asks the prosecutor, would you prepare a proposed sentencing order imposing the death penalty before the sentencing had been completed? Anybody in the world would say, what? That's not allowed.
The evidence was enough to vacate Chris's death sentence. He would no longer be scheduled to die in the electric chair. But Chris was far from a free man. Clive and Ben would now argue for a more lenient sentence for Chris in front of a judge and jury who could once again sentence Chris to death. This was not a trial about innocence or guilt, only the proper punishment, and Chris's wife would look on. At the hearing, the state brought back Chris's familiar detractors, Detective John Burmaster and Neville Butler, who reconfirmed their original testimony.
What did you observe about him?
That he had a gun in one hand and a pillow in the other hand.
The jury was not allowed to hear any of the new evidence Clive had discovered, but they did listen to 24 character witnesses in support of Chris, including Peter Bottomley, Chris's friend from the British Parliament, who testified via satellite.
I both like him and I respect him. I find him the kind of person who I'm pleased to be associated with.
Finally, after 7 days of emotional testimony, the jury would hand down a new sentencing recommendation for Chris.
The jury advises and recommends to the court that it impose a sentence of life imprisonment without the possibility of parole for the first 25 years.
The judge imposed a life sentence. That saved Chris's life.
But that just meant he wasn't on death row anymore. He was still going to die in prison.
Chris's appeals had gone through the Florida courts and the federal level without so much as a hearing about his innocence. So the question remained, why was there so much evidence that Chris did not commit the murders? As it turned out, one man had an answer to that question, a cop who said he was there the day of the murders and knew all about them because he helped cover them up.
Investigations will continue in what is shaping up to be the biggest police corruption scandal in Miami's history.
While Miami police were battling a crime wave in the early 1980s, a new enemy suddenly emerged. Corruption within the ranks.
Particularly in the early 80s, Miami police rushed out and made a lot of hirings without bothering to look too deeply at the people's backgrounds.
Already, 11 officers have been arrested or relieved of duty this year.
They put in additional background investigators, and some of those people were tied into the drug dealers.
The latest allegations go beyond cocaine and cops to charges now of first-degree murder.
We can just say that we are trying to clean our own house.
Everybody that you thought you could trust, you couldn't trust anymore in Miami.
As it turned out, one police officer jailed for corruption would hear about Chris's case and tell Clive he knew what happened because he was there.
I started courting, that's probably the only word for it, a witness who was within the police who could tell the truth. And this officer told me that the police, back in the 1980s, had a deal with the drug dealers where they would protect the murderers who were going around killing people in these drug cases. They would frame someone else for the crime if anyone got onto him. This officer told me, yeah, Chris was framed. It was my former partner who did it, and he told me he'd done it.
It took Clive a full year to convince the former cop, who asked to be called Fred, to go on the record. And in a sworn statement, Fred declared, "I was formerly a police officer in Miami. I was persuaded by another prisoner to tell what I know about Chris Maharaj to his lawyer, Clive Stafford Smith. I do not expect to benefit from doing this. I know the particulars of the Maharaj case. Indeed, I visited the scene of the crime when it happened. I know that Mr. Maharaj was framed because officers investigating the double murder told me flat out they were going to do this. I have a moral duty to help free a man who had been framed and imprisoned for 26 years and spent many of those years on death row. He could have been executed for something he did not do." While Fred may believe the cops in Chris's case were on the take, he has never identified the individuals involved, and no evidence has ever been presented in court to substantiate his claim. But recently, some of Clive's suspicions about who killed the Muyungs were confirmed when he sent someone to Colombia to speak with the man who had been in the room across the hall from the murders. Jaime Vallejo Mejia was flanked by four men with guns when he confirmed the Muyungs had run afoul of Pablo Escobar's drug smuggling operation in the 1980s, and Mejia said the Muyungs had to be dealt with.
every week. I don't tell people about Chris' case. I don't discuss Chris' case because if I tell them, they'll think I'm crazy. He's not losing his hopes and, you know, and that's good.
All I could say about Marita is God sent her to me. She's a blessing sent by God. If I switched places with Marita, I would not have put up with what she did. She's one in a million. She's the heroine of this tragedy.
You cannot have a better husband. Even now that he's in prison, there's nothing he really can do for me. But he has a lot of hope.
In 2008, Clive and Ben Cuney submitted a clemency appeal to the governor of Florida, documenting the actions of police and prosecutors in the case and presenting the new evidence they'd found.
And there was a very strong case for clemency. I mean, Chris had been in prison for over 20 years, which is a long time to serve for anything. But the victim's family showed up en masse. And it was Charlie Crist was the governor at the time, and he instantly denied clemency. By now, Chris is 70 years old. He's in bad health. His poor wife, Marita, stuck by him. I've been representing Chris now for 18 years, and I've failed to get him justice. The most culpable character in Chris's scenario is the justice system, because it's just not interested in justice. As we develop more and more evidence to prove that A, he's innocent, and B, he had an unfair trial, no one wants to listen.